It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Carrie Kaufman. 20 inches of rain in the past 2 weeks caused widespread flooding in Wisconsin, particularly in the southwestern corner of the state. What's being done to help people and businesses affected by these floods? Well, that's one thing on our mind this hour. We'll also talk about trade talks and the effects of U.S. trade policies on Wisconsin's economy. How bad was the flooding where you live? What still needs to be repaired? Were the roads badly damaged? What precautions do you think Wisconsin should take to prevent further flooding damage in the future? What are your questions for Representative Ron Kind on this issue? And are you affected by the farm bill? Are you a farmer or a rancher in Wisconsin? What concerns you about the bill? Maybe you work with low-income families to secure food. What do you want to see the farm bill include? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is our email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ron Kind is my guest this hour. He is the U.S. Representative for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. Congressman, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, John. Glad to be with you. And it's hard to believe it's been 17 years already since September. It takes a moment to pause and reflect today and say a little prayer for the victims and their families who are still suffering today.
Absolutely. Speaking of suffering, there's quite a bit of suffering in your district as the southwestern part of the state has gotten 20 inches of rain in the past couple of weeks. What are you seeing on the ground as you tour that part of your district? What does it look like?
Yeah, you know, we got a real gut punch with this intense, concentrated rain again. First of all, I'm glad we avoided another natural disaster Sunday night. How horrible the Packers played that first half, only to see Aaron Rodgers come back and play a great second half. I mean, who does that? But, you know, this flooding was unique in the fact that it was so intense, so concentrated in certain areas. I mean, 15 inches in a little over 1 hour. And these rivers and streams had nowhere to go but up. And the devastation and the swiftness of the current was so powerful. Businesses, residentials, left a lot of damage in that wake. And then last week, we had some additional rain, so there was a double crest situation in certain areas. And what makes it unique is you've got mass devastation in one area, and then just maybe a quarter of a mile up the road, absolutely nothing, as if nothing ever happened. But as bad as the damage was, and it was tough on those families and business owners, it was also inspirational seeing how quickly the community responded, from the first responders to the sheriff's offices who were out there rescuing people from their homes or from their businesses, and from complete strangers just willing to donate and chip in and help out and show up with the cleanup. And that's been an ongoing project. So a lot more work needs to be done. We're coordinating with the county emergency management personnel. We're trying to get a final damage estimate to see if we do, in fact, qualify for federal disaster aid, which I'm confident that we will here in the state, and then try to get people back on their feet and back to a sense of normalcy as quickly as possible.
What are you hearing from your constituents about the flooding?
Well, you know, it happened so fast. I mean, some of them went to bed. They know it was a heavy rainfall, and the next minute there was a knock on their second floor window, a boat outside saying, "We got to evacuate you right now." And then the mud in its wake. If anyone's ever dealt with this type of flooding, you know, it's just the mud that gets transferred and laid in basements and on first floors and just affecting everything. And that's pretty tough to overcome, too. But, I mean, I was impressed that the county health departments had cleanup kits ready to go. So many people showing up with buckets full of bleach and cleanup supplies literally overnight to help people clean up. And yet it's going to take some time, you know, with the mold and the mildew that comes up after the drying occurs. So roughly 582 homes is the estimate we have so far that was affected directly. Fortunately, we did get a release of federal funds for emergency road repairs on the public roads. Bridges have been inspected to make sure that they're in a safe structural state right now. And I'm also encouraging farmers who are looking at a pretty good crop harvest this fall who are impacted to contact their local Farm Service Administration offices and give them damage numbers. So if there is some federal relief, we're going to be able to hopefully provide some help with the family farmers impacted by this as well.
You mentioned federal relief, and that you're confident that some will be coming. Certainly, earlier this summer, there was probably the second or maybe even the third 100-year rainfall up in northern Wisconsin in the last 5 or 6 years. And so widespread flooding there and in other parts of the state, nothing happening, but certainly more than just one area has had a problem with flooding this summer. You and other members of Congress, I understand, are coming together to ask the Trump administration for emergency relief funds for the flooding. At what point did you realize this would be necessary?
Well, you know, the morning after, when you saw the breadth of the devastation, the amount of damage that I've personally witnessed getting out into Monroe and Adams and Vernon Crawford counties, it seemed pretty clear based on history that this was going to qualify. We're still working closely with the State Emergency Management Office. They're the ones ultimately that will work with the governor to put in the formal request, and I'm sure the federal delegation will be very supportive of all of that. But they're still getting the final damage numbers, and there's a formula that FEMA uses in order to trigger federal assistance on a per capita basis. And again, if history is any guide, we're going to be able to exceed that threshold. And then the next step is getting the FEMA crews in on the ground, doing a door-by-door knock and inspection. And my staff will certainly be next to them as they conduct all of it to make sure that it's being expedited as fast as possible.
Let's take a phone call. Gary is with us this morning from Boscobel. Gary, thanks for joining us on the morning show. What's your question for Congressman Kind?
Well, I live here in the Driftless region, and I've experienced flood damage on my property about every 5 years or so. And I even had some FEMA assistance one time. But it doesn't seem to make sense to me to get federal funding, come in and make repairs to all this flood damage, only to have the potential happen over and over again without preparing in some other way. And years ago, the federal government commended these Coulee regions, and they funded and created and built little catch dams at the head of a lot of these little valleys to catch the runoff and allow it to drain off slowly or to be taken into the ground. And all of these little catch dams now have silted full of topsoil or have been breached and have been left unrepaired. And until we find a way to reduce the amount of water running off these steep hillsides in such a enormous amount and so quickly, all we're going to be doing is trying to play catch-up. And it seemed like a lot of this money should be put into requiring farmers to put in grass waterways and buffer strips and catch dams to keep this water from coming down these valleys and causing all this damage so quickly.
We have just about 30 seconds before we have to go to a break here, Congressman.
Yeah, Gary makes a few very important points. We live in a beautiful area, but Mother Nature makes us pay a price for it. These earthen dams that Gary was talking, I'm hoping to make that a part of the conversation with FEMA. We've got to start repairing and bringing them up to speed. And it's an important reason why we have to have a strong conservation title coming out of the Farm Bill. I've been one of the strongest advocates of these conservation programs so we can reduce sediment and nutrient flows off from our land. So all those points, I think, are very valid. And finally, I want to give people options. 10 years ago, major flooding, we had a relocation program to get people out of floodway. Gaze Mills, half the town was moved uphill. Mm-hmm. So that they didn't have to experience frequent flooding. We need those type of options again.
Okay. Well, to pick that up on the other side of our break, Congressman, we're talking with U.S. Representative Ron Kind about the flooding that's caused serious damage to a lot of the state over the last few weeks. I'm John Munson in for Kerry Kaufman on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kerry Kaufman. Congressman Ron Kind is with us this morning, and we've been talking about flooding in Wisconsin thanks to all this rain we've had recently. And coming up, we're going to be talking about the Farm Bill and trade disputes. That's coming up. But first, we've got a little bit more to go, I think, on the flooding. Some callers who have questions about it and comments. Let's take Dan in Milwaukee next. Dan, hello. Thanks for joining us on the morning show. Dan? Hello? I think we lost Dan. I don't hear him. Dan's point was we need to be able to readily acknowledge climate change in the state, at the state and federal government levels, and if we are going to seriously address these flooding issues. Congressman, what do you think?
I agree. I'm part of this Climate Solutions Caucus. It's the bipartisan caucus. There has to be one R and one D as a member in order to grow the ranks. And we're long overdue to taking a serious bipartisan approach to combat global warming. I mean, just take a look at this year alone in America. We've had major disasters in Tornado Alley, the forest fires out west. The irony was the week before the flooding in Wisconsin, I was out west inspecting in their national parks the forest fires that are occurring there and our response to them. Now we have a Category 4 bearing down on the East Coast this week with a flooding here in the upper Midwest. It does seem these storms are getting more intense, and it does fit the global warming climate models, what the experts have been predicting for some time. And yet Congress is sitting on its hands, dithering, and the president is withdrawing us from the Paris Agreement, and we are the only nation in the world now, in the world, that's not a part of that collective response to global warming. And we're heading in the wrong direction as a country, I feel.
Okay. Let's move on to the Farm Bill. You mentioned that in reference to conservation efforts that might help prevent future flooding. But let's talk about the Farm Bill. I want to toss this out to our listeners and then ask you a question about it. Listeners, are you affected by the Farm Bill? Are you a farmer or rancher? What concerns you about the bill? Maybe you work with low-income families to secure food. What do you want the Farm Bill to include? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Quickly, before we get to the Farm Bill, let's talk a little bit about tariffs. China's leaders say they'll retaliate if the U.S. extends tariffs on their goods. President Trump said Friday he was considering adding tariffs to $267 billion worth of Chinese products. What do you make of this, Congressman?
Well, trade wars never go according to plan. They usually hurt all the countries involved, and we're certainly seeing that in this instance. The tariffs are having an adverse impact on our manufacturers, on our family farmers, and I am all for trying to level the playing field and having a good trade agreement that elevates standards to where we are, whether it's strong worker protections, environmental human rights standards, intellectual property protections. But we ought to be doing that through the process of negotiation rather than unilateral tariffs done with bogus reasons, which only invites to retaliation. China is a classic example. They've been cheating. They haven't been playing by the rules. But they've been doing that to everyone, not just to us, John. And now is the time for the president to show true leadership and form an international coalition to stand up to China and say we're not going to tolerate it anymore. And then it's harder for them to retaliate just against us. I'm confident that that coalition exists out there. But instead, the president is applying tariffs on our friends and foes alike and declaring some of our closest, most loyal allies as national security threats to the United States, which makes absolutely no sense. So I think his approach and methodology is all off, and it's having an adverse economic impact on many people back home. And there's a better way of addressing these trade relations than the route that the president has chosen to take.
Now, the Farm Bill expires at the end of the month, and we have a caller on the line who wants to address one aspect of that Farm Bill. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hello. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. I moved up here, and I went to vote, and I saw your name on the ballot, and I was so thrilled. I was just tickled pink that I could have a reasonable human being in the Congress. I am elderly disabled, and I live at 60% of the federal poverty level, which is interesting. And Scott Walker, over the course of his time in office, has reduced my food stamps by 90%. I get 10% of what I used to get. At least I used to get 10% of what I used to get. I'll get to that in a second. And a lot of elderly people are getting only $10 a month or something like that. And that's because it's administrated by the states, and I don't think that that should be the way it is done, but that's the way it is done. And every time I get a cost of living increase from the federal government on my disability, they take it out of my food stamps. So I'm, in essence, not getting a cost of living increase. And the other thing I wanted to say, and that needs to change. I mean, people are just struggling to feed themselves. And the other thing I wanted to say is that as an elderly person, I get a USDA food box every month. Well, I have terrible food allergies, and I opened it up the first time, and I was aghast. I was aghast because there was nothing in it I could eat virtually, but there also was nothing in there that anybody should eat. It was all high fructose corn syrup, white flour, garbage food. And so I protested and called around, and nobody could do anything about it. But I'm wondering if some kind of special dispensation can be made for people on special diets, people
okay.
who have diabetes.
Yeah, Chris, we're running out of time. I'd like to give the congressman a chance to respond. What about the SNAP program as part of the Farm Bill? What can we do to address some of Chris's concerns?
Yeah, well, John, I encourage Chris to contact my office so we can look into the particulars of her situation and see if something can be worked out given her special dietary needs. But she's also kind of a classic member of the demographics who do receive this food assistance program through the Farm Bill. Over 72% of them are, you know, seniors or children or individuals with disability. And so it's a major point of contention right now in the Farm Bill negotiations is how to reform that program. And I don't think that we're going to be demanding that those people who are seniors or disabled or young children have to go out and get a job first before they qualify for food assistance. So that all has to be worked out. But it's an important program. It affects many families and many lives. We should be able to find a safe landing zone for it. It's a win-win situation because the farmers benefit from this food assistance buy-up program, too. And yet it's an important feature of farm bills every 5 years when they come up. So I certainly hope that we can resolve this because it does serve an important purpose.
What about Chris's point about who administers the SNAP program specifically? The states are involved, and they get to set the benefits.
Yeah, you know, typically it's been done that fashion, but obviously it all depends on the leadership of the state and how they view the programs and whether it's going to work to try to make it work well and better or whether they just use it as a political punching bag. And so that's really what it comes down to. You know, we've never had this problem before until some governors started to politicize the program in order to make some point, and unfortunately we're seeing more of that taking place.
So let's talk about the Farm Bill in general. In order to get a thumbs up from you on the renewal of this program, what needs to be in it? What are the must-haves for Ron Kind?
Well, I would still like to see important payment limitation caps in the Title I subsidy program. So much of taxpayer subsidies are going to a few but very large agribusiness, and it's hurting our family farmers. It's leading to more consolidation in agriculture, driving up land values, squeezing the family farmers out of business. I don't feel that's been adequately addressed yet in this bill. In fact, I just had a CBO report come back saying it is so rife with fraud and manipulation that these payment limits are difficult to institute unless they're done very targeted. I also want to see a strong conservation title. I mean, the House Farm Bill that passed completely eliminates the Conservation Stewardship Program, close to $1 billion being taken out of that when we have great need for sound conservation programs back home. And we have to have a strong New Beginning Farmer program in it, and I'm the representative of the largest organic co-op in the world, Organic Valley. We've been working very hard with organic farmers to make sure we have a strong organic title in this farm bill as well.
And today, of course, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, is September 11th, a solemn day across the country, especially New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington. That's where the hijacked planes crashed in 2011, killing thousands. What do you want to acknowledge today, and how can lawmakers in Washington work together to better national security today?
Well, this would be a perfect time to do a look back. I mean, the 9/11 Commission came out with certain specific recommendations of what we need to do to enhance our national security, especially as it relates to these terrorist attacks right now, and make sure that we're breaking down the silos that existed back then. We had agencies not communicating with each other, therefore not connecting the dots in order to prevent these attacks. We should should be doing a thorough review to make sure that everything that can be done is being done to enhance that coordination. Got to deal with this as a team approach, not as individual agencies just trying to grab more and more power and internalizing it. And I'm afraid there are still remnants of that that exist today.
And a final thought for us, what do you personally think when you look at this day and this special anniversary?
Well, just how tragic the day was, whether it was New York or Shanksville or even Washington, D.C. But it was certainly a jolt to our national psyche. We're still responding, 17 years later, and have spent trillions of dollars in response because of 18 hijackers with box cutters that were able to commandeer these planes and use them as flying bombs. And our response in many areas has been overreach, unnecessary wars in the Middle East, and engendering more of that type of backlash against us.
And we'll have to leave it there, Congressman. Ron Kind, U.S. Representative for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, thank you so much for joining us. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kerry Kaufman today. At the U.S. Open this weekend, Serena Williams faced off against 20-year-old Naomi Osaka of Japan and, stunningly, lost. Leading up to her defeat, a series of violations and accusations of sexism forcing the tennis world to revisit questions of gender standards and inconsistent enforcement of rules. We talked to a sports writer about that in this portion of The Morning Show. Wondering what you think. Did you watch the U.S. Open? What was your opinion on what happened between Serena Williams and the chair umpire during her match with Naomi Osaka? Do you think there is a double standard for male and female tennis players, and why or why not? And what about sports in general? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Ava Wallace, reporter for The Washington Post, covering college sports, the WNBA, and tennis. Ava Wallace, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
At the U.S. Open over the weekend, Serena Williams was penalized several times during a game that she ultimately lost. It was the first time a Japanese player has won a Grand Slam singles title, but what happened bordered on pandemonium for tennis, which is usually a pretty restrained sport, John McEnroe aside. Can you explain what happened for us from beginning to end there?
Sure thing. So the kind of hubbub started in the second set after Naomi Osaka had taken the first set off of Serena Williams, which does not happen often, especially it doesn't happen often in a Grand Slam final. But in the first set early or in the second set early on, Serena Williams is given a warning, a coaching violation, because her coach, Patrick Mouratoglou, is seen by the chair umpire, Carlos Ramos, for giving her signals on court. And in the replay, we all see it's kind of hard. I was sitting courtside. You couldn't actually see it. He's kind of sitting across the court from the press. But he was telling her to, using his hands and motioning to move up to net, telling her to go up to net. She said she wasn't looking at the time. We see her stop after Carlos Ramos says, hey, this is your warning for a coaching violation. She goes to him. She says, hey, we don't have coaching signals. I wasn't receiving coaching. I don't look to my box. That's not how I play. I don't cheat to win. I would rather lose than cheat to win. That's the first thing. Then the second code violation she receives is for racket abuse in kind of the middle of the second set after Naomi Osaka breaks her serve. She's still in the lead at 3-2, but she breaks her racket. She's frustrated. This 20-year-old is outplaying her and handling the moment really well. And he gives her a coaching violation and takes a point from Serena Williams. That's when she gets kind of upset with the chair umpire there, because she thought that after she had that conversation with him about the coaching violation that they were cool, things were all settled. So she thinks she shouldn't be having this point taken away from her. And he says, sorry, no, that's still stood as a warning. Then when she starts kind of going off, she gets very irate. That's when she calls him a thief. That's kind of the word that's been definitely focused in on in the reporting in the past couple of days. That's when he docks her a game and puts Naomi Osaka a game away from the championship.
So how surprising was this series of events, especially given that it was a Grand Slam final?
Yeah, it was really shocking. I, Serena Williams has a couple of incidents in her past at the U.S. Open in particular, where we've seen some really stunning things on court. But I've never seen this in a Grand Slam final. All of those incidents I'm referring to, I think people may remember when, you know, she threatened a line judge at the U.S. Open, and or she was received she actually received an apology from the USTA in 2004 for such poor line calling on one of her matches. But those were all in the quarterfinals and the semifinals. This is a Grand Slam final. To see Serena Williams get so emotional and you know, really let the chair umpire have at it in a Grand Slam final was stunning. And to add to that, I think the atmosphere was so tense. There were so many people in Arthur Ashe Stadium. It's a 24,000-seat stadium, and most everybody was there to support, to spur Serena on. She was going for her 24th Grand Slam title. That would be a record, an all-time record-tying title, tying Margaret Court's record that she set in 1973. So people were there to see history. Everyone, you know, was on her side. And when this started happening, the crowd started booing. And Arthur Ashe Stadium is kind of built like a coliseum. So the court, you're at the very bottom, obviously, and everyone's just kind of up around you in this bowl. So when they start booing, you can really hear it. And the atmosphere just grew so uncomfortable. And when she's defending herself to the chair umpire, it was loud, it was harsh language, it was stuff that you just don't necessarily always see in tennis. So it was really kind of stunning what was going on.
Let's go back just a moment. The first warning that Williams got was for a coaching violation. Why is being coached by your coach during a match against the rules? And how widely is this rule actually enforced?
Yeah, so that's kind of the question. It's against the rules just because on-court coaching, you're supposed to be out there by yourself in tennis, pretty much. The WTA and its tour events does allow on-court coaching, but a Grand Slam final is obviously different, and you're not allowed to do it in a Grand Slam. And you have to, even in WTA tour events, there's special times, you know, you call for it during the changeover and things like that. It's not like someone can just from the box yell out suggestions or directions or anything like that. That said, it happens all the time that someone looks at their coach, they get a thumbs up after they do something correctly, you know, telling them, yes, keep doing that, do it again. It's little things like that, just natural things. When you're a coach there watching your player play and they look up at you, you're going to say something back. It happens all the time, and it is really inconsistently enforced. That's the thing about chair umpiring, is you go by the book, but there's still a lot of discretion. We saw it earlier in the U.S. Open. There was a moment when a chair umpire, Mohamed Layani, actually gets down from his chair and goes over to a male tennis player, Nick Kyrgios, and who looks like he's about to retire from the match and give up and doesn't want to play. He says, come on, you're better than this. So it's clear that chair umpires have discretion to use. And, you know, sometimes they say, hey, I see your coach giving you signals, tell him to knock it off, or I'm going to give you a warning, something like that. There's a lot of leeway there.
In reaction to all of this, Serena Williams said that male athletes behave in worse ways but aren't penalized for it, that she was punished because of her gender. Do you think there's some truth in that?
So I definitely understand where she's coming from. It's not, you know, as a reporter, obviously, it's not my job to kind of take sides, but Carlos Ramos, the chair umpire, was going by the books. He has the coaching violation. That's a warning, racket abuse. That's another, that's a point. And then the third coaching violation, you take a game. That's absolutely by the rule book. If you're umpiring in a vacuum there, that's what you should do. But Serena Williams, throughout her career, her, you know, two decades long career, has spent a lot of time defending her integrity and, you know, starting with the way that she looks. It's her body is really strong, and it was something that when she came on the scene in the late 90s, no one had ever seen in tennis before. So there's a lot of things that happened to her when she wins. People then say, you're too strong to win. You must be doping, or you must be doing this, whatever. You're not normal. She spent a lot of her career defending her integrity and defending the way she looks and the way she acts and sounds on court. So I can absolutely understand why her mind would go there. You know, she understood the coaching warning to be someone questioning her integrity, her saying, calling her a cheater, saying that she needs coaching to win. So, you know, especially when you think of the example, you mentioned John McEnroe up top. where, you know, he was known for his tantrums, and the same thing with Jimmy Connors and James Blake and Andy Roddick, two former top American players, came out afterward on Twitter and said, "I've said way worse and never been warned on a tennis court." So I can see where her, why her mind went there, absolutely.
So her calling the chair umpire a thief was probably tamer than what a lot of her male counterparts would have said?
I've heard worse on a tennis court for sure. You know, there was no profanity or anything. The issue there, of course, is that in the rule book, that's technically, I guess, could be interpreted as questioning a chair umpire's integrity. And that is where the verbal abuse call came into play.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Serena Williams wore an outfit with tight-fitting leggings during the French Open a few months ago. It was banned after the fact, even though she was wearing it in part to prevent post-childbirth blood clots. Do female tennis players have to wear skirts? Is that an actual rule, or is it just sort of one of these unwritten rules in tennis?
No, it's not an actual rule. Actually, someone, I think probably one of the first top players that we saw wear shorts regularly is Victoria Azarenka, and not a lot of players do it nowadays still. You see a lot of players practicing in shorts. I would say that's probably what they normally practice in. It is not a hard and fast rule, but Grand Slams, of course, can enforce dress codes when they want to. We see it at Wimbledon. That's the easiest example. We've got the all-white dress code. So the French Tennis Federation president said, you know, you have to respect the game. You have to respect the time and place, kind of implying that the full pant cat suit that she was wearing, as it's come to be called, was not respecting the French Open and the time and the place. Female players do not have to wear skirts. That's not in the rule books.
We're talking with Ava Wallace, reporter for the Washington Post, covering college sports, the WNBA, and, of course, tennis. And tennis is what's on our minds. What happened at the U.S. Open this past weekend involving Serena Williams has opened a discussion about gender standards and inconsistent enforcement of the rules of tennis. So is just to kind of put a nail in this, is there a double standard in the sport, and how does it manifest itself?
I think there is a double standard in the sport just because there's a double standard in society, honestly, if we're talking really broadly there. There's an expectation for how women in general and female athletes act. There's an expectation for decorum, especially in tennis, which again has deep history as a country club sport. You know, women started playing the game wearing long skirts and these long dresses and things like that, and weren't allowed in country clubs for a long time. I definitely think there's a double standard. You know, when John McEnroe made his career, at least partly off of these tantrums, he gets called a brat and celebrated a little bit. You know, it's kind of a cheeky nickname. And when we see, you know, as with any other thing, when we see women going on a tirade, they're hysterical, emotional, questioning people's integrity. That's something Serena Williams herself mentioned.
We need to go to a break, and we'll come back and continue our discussion. If you'd like to join us, 800-642-1234. What did you think about the events at the U.S. Open this past weekend? 800-642-1234. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Carrie Kaufman. We will be right back. Show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Carrie Kaufman. We're taking a look back at the U.S. Open and what happened in the women's final, and we're interested in your reaction. Did you watch the match? And if so, what did you think of the way it was handled? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ava Wallace is my guest. She is a reporter for the Washington Post, covering college sports, the WNBA, and, of course, tennis. We have some callers who want to join us. We'll get to them in just a moment. One of the other factors, in addition to sexism charges that were leveled, and charges is probably the really bad word to use here, is there a racial element to all of this that we should be talking about as well?
I think because Serena Williams brought it up, I think we owe it its due for sure. And that's, I think, again, goes into the things that she's experienced throughout her career, going back to Indian Wells early in her career, where her father and her sister said they were, subject to racist taunts at the tournament out in California that's kind of considered the sport's fifth major. It's just another thing that she's faced in addition to the way her body looks, the way she acts on court. It's a real othering. And so I think that's why she kind of went to that, you know, I'm a black woman on court who's been called this angry black woman and everything like that. And just because I look different, sound different, act different, that's something she's had to defend herself against.
Let's take a phone call. Rick in Beloit is with us. Rick, hello. Good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Good morning. What I'm asking is, have they looked at the way this judge has decided other matches and so forth? Is he known to be a strict judge? Nobody's bringing that issue up. Well, what's the deal with him?
Rick, thanks for the call. What about the judge, the referee that was there? Does he have a history of calls like this?
Yeah, that's a really, really great point, and I'm glad it was brought up. That's why I think, you know, the accusation of sexism is a really serious one, and that's why I think it's good to talk this through before anybody kind of makes a real decision on that, because Carlos Ramos, the chair umpire, is known for being a stickler, and he's given tough calls like this on ticky-tacky stuff to guys like Rafael Nadal and Novak Djokovic, too. It's not... That's why I think the accusation is really serious, because I do think Carlos Ramos has a history of these really strict things. He's not one of the refs who's going to say, hey, you say one more thing to me and I'm going to take a game from you. He's just going to let you go on and then take the game from you, as we saw on Saturday. But yeah, he is absolutely known for being a very by the book guy.
Rick, thanks for that call. Mary is next in Beloit. Mary, hello. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. I just wanted to expand a little bit more on the societal issue of the male versus female. And we see it in politics as well as in sports, that oftentimes when women raise their voice to a man, they revert to a little boy who's being yelled at by their mother. And as a strong woman in the workforce, I too have seen this, because I've been called the mom in several situations where I work, when I say no to whatever's going on in the situation. Care to expand on that?
Mary, thanks so much for that call. Ava Wallace?
Yeah, that's what people are, that's I think where people are latching on to this accusation of sexism. Again, one of our columnists at the Post, Sally Jenkins, phrased it as, you know, Carlos Ramos took a game from her immediately because he couldn't take being spoken sharply to by a woman. So I think a lot of people, not just Serena Williams, identified with that, where you see these male players cursing and saying, you know, don't ever talk to me again and all these things and profanity. And Serena Williams calls him a thief. And that's kind of where he draws the line. So I think it, for sure, a lot of people, a lot of women I know in particular, saw or kind of flashed to situations where they've been punished for voicing their minds. And that's how Serena Williams phrased it. She says, I want women to be able to be emotional on court and to express their ideas on court without being penalized for it, mm-hmm. without being told to, you know, be quiet, sit down, go over there.
We have another caller, Orson in Whitewater, who I think will be making a comment that echoes what Martina Navratilova wrote in an op-ed for the New York Times. Let's take Orson's call. Orson, thanks for joining us on the morning show today.
Thanks, John. Yeah, I just went through all the clips last night, as well as an excellent portrayal by Patrick McEnroe. She really brought it upon herself, though. I feel like she had the opportunity to express herself between the first warning. That's when she knows she needs to be careful. When she smacked a racket, there's no argument that that is a penalty. And then when she was arguing with the chair umpire, she just kept going and going, and then she told him to stop talking to her. And he did. And that's when a normal chair umpire might give somebody a little talk and say, hey, this is the time where you need to slow down or you're going to get a game against you and nobody wants that here. But she told him to be quiet. And then she just kept going after she told him to be quiet. And that's when he gave her the game penalty. So I think she brought it on herself, unfortunately. But Naomi played amazing, and it wouldn't have mattered, I don't think.
Orson, thanks for the call. Ava?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the first things I meant, where, you know, you don't see something like this often in tennis. And it was really stunning to see her raise her voice like that at Carlos Ramos. And of course, she's playing in her 31st Grand Slam final of her career. She knows the rules of tennis by now, and she knows what she can and can't say to a chair umpire. There is the argument on the other side a lot of people are bringing up when she starts going on that third tirade before she calls him a thief. The umpire does have the opportunity to say, hey, you got to cool your jets, or I'm going to do this. A lot of chair umpires would have done that. Carlos Ramos, that's not his style. I'm not sure if Serena Williams was aware of that. He does call a lot more men's matches, and she said afterwards that, you know, we don't have any history. He's a good umpire. So she lost her cool for sure. She absolutely played a part in this on Saturday. I don't think that's something that you can deny.
Orson, thanks for the call. Todd in Green Bay, you're next. Todd, thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Good morning. Yeah, I watched the entire event as it unfolded and exploded. And Serena was absolutely 100% at fault here. There was no reason for her outburst other than her own frustration, and which she couldn't contain. And this business about going on and on about, I have a daughter and I'm trying to be a good role model. Well, I thought if her daughter were to watch her replay this, you know, 20 years from now when her daughter's old enough to understand what's going on, her daughter would be ashamed of her mother. It was just a horrible outburst. And like you said, she's a veteran. She knows the rules. She should be able to, she's an adult. She should be able to act like one on the court and accept the consequences, the smaller consequences that she got. So to the point where it doesn't lead up to a larger consequence. And she would have lost that match anyway. She was just getting thumped.
Todd, we get it. Thank you very much for your call. Ava Wallace?
Yeah, that's obviously something that I don't think that's someone's singular opinion. That's something that a lot of people are saying. She was actually asked afterwards in a news conference, you know, how would you explain this to your daughter in 20 years when she inevitably sees the clip? And that's kind of when Serena Williams said, well, I would say to my daughter, I hope you stand up for yourself when you're presented a situation like that on the tennis court or in business, in life, whatever. And that's when she kind of said, I hope you don't back down. I hope you're allowed to express your emotions the way I was without being penalized. So, you know, Serena took that in a different direction. A lot of people were really uncomfortable with her invoking her daughter in that situation. I think the other point is he's absolutely right. She was losing that match, and there is a reason she got so flustered. Is this 20-year-old across the court from her was doing really well and was beating her. So, you know, if she's winning that match, she probably doesn't get as frustrated. Obviously, we don't know. We can't say that for sure. But there was a surefire reason, and that's because Naomi Osaka was on her way to winning her first Grand Slam title.
We've got about 30 seconds or so left here in this hour. Do you think, Ava Wallace, that what happened with Serena Williams this weekend will bring about any changes in the sport of tennis at the Grand Slam level?
I am unsure about that just because tennis, like most sports, is very, very slow to change. We saw the USTA and the WTA, the women's tour, come out in support of Serena Williams. I think the thing here that if anything were to be changed, what would be looked at was the rule book and how inconsistently and varied the rules of tennis are enforced. And if there was one thing that they could concretely do away with, it would be looking at the rule book and looking at their chair umpires, I think.
All right, Ava Wallace, thank you so much for joining me this morning on The Morning Show. Ava Wallace is a reporter for The Washington Post covering college sports, the WNBA, and tennis. I'm John Munson in for Kerry Kaufman. You're listening to the Ideas Network.